Hi, I'm Rob Grizz and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Glyn Mason. Glyn, thanks for talking with me. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born on the 12th of the 9th, 1949 in Nottingham, England.
What would be your earliest memory?
Well, really, my father was a recipient of the English post-war relocation program, which became known as the Ten Quidders. So the English government, post the Second World War, sent out a memo to the majority of their servicemen and women saying, we'll help you relocate anywhere in the world for £10, you and your family.
Right.
And as you could imagine, like a lot of those folks, servicemen had met gals overseas during the war in France and Germany and wherever, and also fighting in the Pacific and all sorts of points west. A lot of them wanted to go there. And at this particular point, for £10, why wouldn't you? So him and my mum boarded a ship, and out they came when I was only three. So I actually have very little memory of the UK at that specific time.
Sure, sure.
What I remember, and it became sort of relatively vivid looking at some photos of that first boat trip, was that you would come down via the Suez Canal and all of that sort of stuff. And a lot of the boats were English troop carriers from the P&O line, like the Somersetshire and the Moreton Bay, and all sort of weird kind of ships like that. I think we came on the Somersetshire, but I honestly can't remember, to tell you the truth. There were some photos that my folks had of me playing on the deck with a bunch of, like, you know, the solid steel toys, with some of the native people that used to pull up on the boats selling wares.
Oh, okay.
And they used to get the gilly-gilly man, and the magic guy, to come up on board and entertain all the people on board the ships on brief stopovers like the Suez Canal and stuff, where you had to stop for a half a day or something while they went through all the passports and bizzo. So those kind of things are about my earliest memories that I really recall. You know,
what was the destination? Australia.
Australia, yeah. So we came out to Australia, and we settled in Richmond in 1952.
Right.
And Dad was recommissioned to join the RAAF out here because he'd been in the RAF in the UK.
Right.
And during the war, he was stationed in Canada with the teaching navigation and stuff to the flyers there. So he came out there, and he ended up at the barracks as a clerk, service clerk, in St Kilda Road, the main barracks.
What sort of man was he?
Well, he was a wiry little Welsh miner's son. He was down the mines himself when he was 11 years old.
Wow.
As you can imagine, probably a massive amount of those days were, you know, like England was going through depressions as well, and previous outcomes of wars and European conflicts. And I would have probably imagined that he never spoke much about his life or his family for that reason. But he did say he comes from Pontypridd, which is about, I don't know, 80 miles south of Cardiff in Wales. And his father was a horticulturalist as well as a miner, like, you know, just sort of studied the and became a horticulturalist just purely by tending the graves in the local church.
Wow, okay.
So Dad was a singer. He was a choir boy. So I would have imagined he was, you know, rough and tumble like most of them were from around the world of the same era and hard people.
How do you remember him, though, as a father?
Oh, I don't think I was particularly close to Dad, like, you know, in the real terms, you know, like, you know. But he was, him and Mum, as were that generation, absolute workers. They just worked all their lives.
That was a real generational thing, absolutely right.
Worked all their lives.
What sort of woman was your mother?
Well, she was a great gal. She was...
Was she Welsh?
No, she was born in the Sound of Bow Bell, so she was a Cockney in London.
Okay.
Yeah. And honky-tonk piano player.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so she was good. And,
So do you have memories of her playing piano?
Oh, yeah. Her and Dad used to, you know, all... I guess I'd give you some sort of timeline. So we came out to Australia in 52, stayed here and Richmond, and then we also shifted to Frankston. And that was easier just for Dad to get in the train to go to St Kilda Barracks. And Mum was working at General Motors Holden then, GM.
Yeah, George,
yeah. And, you know, she was same thing in the clerical position there. And, you know, you grabbed whatever work you could get, like when you came out kind of thing, like most of the POMs. And if it wasn't there, it was like the ex-army sort of base stuff down in Elizabeth and Adelaide, which is like famous for Jimmy Barnes and all this kind of family and friends and mob that obviously moved out around probably similar times, you know.
Yeah.
There was just lots of English people and Scottish and that immigration pact that came out here at that time, I would imagine. Anyway, so that we stayed there for stayed in Australia then till 1958, and strangely enough, there was more jobs advertised in the Australian papers for New Zealand at the time than there was for jobs in Australia.
Oh.
You know, there was most of the work here. You could get jobs, and you know, why couldn't you? And the opportunity was here, no doubt about that. But for what my father was capable of doing, New Zealand was the place. So we took off in 59.
So you'd have some pretty clear memories of that trip then. You would have been about nine, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. We just took over across on a boat.
Yeah.
You know, away we went. And he took up a position as the head gardener at Omaru Gardens. And the thing about most jobs over there in those days was that the job came with a house.
Oh.
Right? So you could kind of like move into the caretaker's house. Or, you know, and so Dad kind of like followed quite a lot of that stuff around. So we were in New Zealand for 11 years, ending up in Wellington, out in the Hutt Valley, which is about 15 k's around the bay there. And he and Mum basically stayed there till they sort of like passed away.
Mm.
And I came back here in 69. So, you know, when you're getting back to like my mum, my memories of her were obviously, you know, I was the only child to that particular pairing because my mum had been married before.
Okay.
And as I also sort of later found out many years later, in actual fact about a year and a half ago, so was my father.
That would have been a surprise then.
It was incredibly surprising.
Yeah.
But that's a kind of another world. That's another story.
Yes.
So my mum was great. Again, always a hard worker, just worked all of her life until she... pretty much passed away.
Mm.
She had sort of health issues in a mid to late life, and she passed away in 69.
A lot of that generation did seem to die, if we can put it this way, prematurely, and I often wonder if it's not partly the stress of the war years, because they must have gone through a lot.
Possibly so. I don't know. I mean, all I ever think of when I look at pictures of most of those people, sure, I think anybody would get weary of the world of conflict, any type of conflict.
Mm.
So if you're in England, and England, you know, for example, got involved in the war and they were physically attacked. So when you come under that sort of, you know, daily threat, you know, and you've got bombs and then you've got V-bombs and then you've got whatever else it is, you've got the potential of losing members of your family. Members of your family are overseas. You've still got to try and live, so you've still got to try and go to work, and you've got to do this, and you've got to do that. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it. But I think they were incredibly hardy people, really hardy people. Like most of the countries I can think of that have been down, and particularly of those eras. Like if you think about like pre that and into the Victorian era and all that. Man, like they were tough people, man. Like the common people were tough.
Yes.
They were like frigging rocks, you know.
Yes.
And my father was probably a kind of an element of that. You know, he was a shorter man, but he was wiry. Like he was really tough and hard work.
Well, you're going to be tough and hard, aren't you? Working in the mines as a boy, basically. He's only a boy.
All of that.
Yeah.
So it was common, sort of. You know, it was common as, I mean, families were doing it, man. Whole communities were doing that stuff, as you remember.
Mm.
All tied up in the mine, right?
And
they went there and the women did this and they worked and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I mean, it would have been tough, man. Yeah. Yeah, real hard.
You as a boy, do you have recollections of early school years?
Yeah, well, obviously, my life was shifting quite a bit, as you can imagine. So when we lobbed here, and when I was of age, I went to the kindergartens, of course, and then I would have gone to an earlier school in Richmond and then out at Frankston, so I shifted there. So there was no way me coming in all the, you know, on the train and stuff in those days. So out there and then to New Zealand. And then in New Zealand we shifted three times.
So did you, would have been hard for you then to form sort of meaningful friendships with kids if you're always on the
road? No, I think people often think that, but I don't believe that's true. I think you just become incredibly adaptable, you know, and I had great friends like, you know, down in Oamaru and guys that I sort of grew up with in the formative years, and then we shifted up to a place called Takapau in the North Island, and my father was taken on as a gardener for a woman called, her name was Mrs. Ralston. She was the third richest woman in New Zealand and a benefactor to the Sacred Heart Colleges, and she had this massive farming property up there. Her husband and her son had died in farming accidents at the property.
Wow.
And she had this huge, absolutely wonderful mansion surrounded by landscape gardens. And on the actual farming properties, there were, I think, 8 or 9 houses that housed all of the main workers, like the head of the cattle sort of section, shall we say, the head of the sheep section, my dad, who was the head.
So you actually lived on the property with her?
Well, on the farming properties. Yeah, that surrounded the homestead, yeah.
That must have been an incredibly healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, it was easy to adapt. I thought it was fantastic. I went out there. I'd never had a dog. I had a dog out there, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And, yeah, Kiwiland itself was, and still is, an amazingly healthy place. For those out there that have been there recently or have grown up there, you know, it's a magnificent geographical part of the world. It's got, what can I say, so many great aspects to it geographically that the rest of the world's got, but they're on just two islands and there's about 3 million people there.
Yes.
You know, you've got like thermal activity, you've got the fields like in Norway, you've got the plain belts like you've got in sort of Montana and stuff in America. Huge areas of, like down in Otago, just like miles and miles of like flat plains and wheat and stuff, you know. You've got volcanoes. You've got some of the best fishing in the world because you've got super deep waters around both islands.
Mm.
So it's an unbelievable joint, you know, really amazing. And I haven't been back for a long time, but it's spectacular.
So as a kid in New Zealand, what did you do for entertainment? How did you, what were things that you used to do?
Well, I wasn't really worried too much about that, obviously, until the explosion of the music in the kind of like the mid-60s, you know, early 60s, right?
So you're in your teens then?
Yeah, but like, you know, some of my earliest memories, obviously, were Dad and Mum partying on with Uncle Fred over there, or one of my sort of many, you know, sort of surrogate uncles, you know, playing pots and pans, you know, at their parties. And all those kind of corny sort of things about sitting at the foot of the stairs in your pyjamas, you know, listening to the oldies going bonkers, you know, like, was all part of it.
Yeah.
And Dad singing, like, you know, going nuts. And they were the earliest musical sort of things that I ever remember. And then Dad bought a gramophone, a wind-up gramophone. Still, he could have bought a electric turntable, but
well, I was wondering about
he
that,
just happened to buy a wind up thing with a whole bunch of 78s. Must have been at like a throw out or some whatever. So that ended up in the lounge room at our place, and on there were like Well, all the classics, all the crooners were on there, early operatic guys, Mario Lanza,
yeah.
You know, and one of my earliest memories of a song was a thing called Pedro the Fisherman, for God's sake. I have no idea who the artist was, but I thought, oh, it's got funky, you know, I used to sing along and make noises and stuff. I grew up like yourself and like many others during that whole sort of era where... you had the kind of the major crooners and the ballad singers, you know, and the Clan, the Sinatra, and all that thing. That they were my earliest, you know, kind of radio memories, because that's what was going on. And then, of course, the revolution started, and you started getting Bill Haley and the kind of rock thing coming through, and then through into the 60s where you had the massive explosion, the whole thing about, you know, the Mersey Sound, the English... sort of invasion per se, and then the world took off
like a rocket.
Well, it was already a rocket in America, but like I remember the big jazz stuff as well, you know, that was prior to that as well. So you had the crooners, you had the massive jazz bands from America, you know, all the huge orchestras, Benny Goodman and all that kind of stuff.
Were you introduced to that through records your dad bought or radio?
No, radio.
So radio played a big part for you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, radio played a massive part, I think, probably for everybody. No computers, you know.
That's right.
No IT stuff, forget all that rubbish, mate. And there you were, just like post-war, crammed around the radio, listening to radio drama, radio plays, news broadcasts from the BBC or, you know, government New Zealand, you know, whatever it might have been. And that was the home entertainment.
It was a central thing, wasn't it? The family used to sit there.
It was massive. Yeah, like we used to do it. Like we still did the same when we got here. Because, yeah. Was it 55 TV in Australia?
56.
56.
The Olympic Games.
Yeah. So, well, I went to the Olympic Games. Like, you know, Dad took me there.
He brought you back to Aussie for that, did he?
We came back in 56 just for the Olympic Games.
Right.
Because we were living there. Because there was quite a few people in Australia and some... two of Dad's closest friends that came out on the boat with him lived in Mentone, right, when it was just pasture land and a couple of buildings sticking up. So he used to come. We used to come back almost annually by plane, Teal Jet Electra, prop driven.
Of course.
You know, no, you know. And, like, so we used to come back, like, quite regularly.
Okay.
And so, anyway, we came back for the games, and I still got the pennant and everything in there, the games. And
you would have been still fairly young, though. You would have only been, what, 7 years of age?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have memories at all of the games? I mean, not clear ones, but...
Well, I do remember the Roger Bannister race, you know, where he won the quarter mile or whatever it was, which was a fantastic thing.
Sure.
At the time, you know. And, I mean, you can imagine those things for a child were larger than life.
Yes.
I mean, you imagine going to a stadium like that and when you're a kid. And
that's right. Massive. That's right. Well, eyeball, you know, stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but we used to come back and Dad would try and time it occasionally, like if the Moomba Festival was on.
Okay.
You know, and like we the early Moomba Festivals. And, yeah, we were in Australia till 58. Later on, we kept coming back when we were in New Zealand. But 56, we went to the games. Right. And then speaking of radio... as a kid, well, of course, I used to listen to all the kids' radio shows with all those half-hour stories about Hopalong Cassidy.
Oh, and the cereals.
Yeah. And the Lost Dutchman Goldmine and stuff.
Yes, yes.
Well, of course, Hoppy was one of my giant heroes. So when William Boyd came out here, Dad took me to, right, to the in actual fact, Botanical Gardens. They had a massive circus marquee set up. Hundreds of kids in there, right, going nuts.
Right?
And he rode in, like on topper, right, and did the thing and all that stuff, and I ended up with a bolo tie thing with a cow skull, and, you know, I was in seventh heaven, right?
Of course.
So speaking of the radio, that's where all, and how powerful that was. It was a massive, massive thing. I mean, let's face it, you got everything out of it. You got all your news, you know, all the stuff that was important to the oldies and...
And entertained, educated, and I mean, there's a saying that radio is the theatre of the imagination. It really helped your imagination, didn't it?
Well, you had to.
You had to.
But that's what made their world, the people who were making the programs, obviously fantastic and so interesting. And I always wanted to be one of those sound effects guys.
Yeah.
I wanted to be one of those guys. But, you know, if you listen to a lot of that stuff, and, man, it gripped you like Dragnet and a lot of those old original things. Yeah. And, man, you were, like, on the edge of your seat.
That's right.
In some of those stories. And what's that famous, the radio play that sent America...
War of the Worlds. Yes.
You know,
yes.
And like the effect that created.
Right. That's right.
And you just sort of go, I mean, you listen to it now and you think, well, it's probably highly possible, because what you're imagining is that on the other end of the line that's going on.
That's right.
Right. And like you, people are sitting there going, oh, you know, and in trance, but not believing in fact whether it was real or in fact false. Just a story.
Yeah.
So, powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Really powerful stuff. And you can, the sad indictment of that was that, you know, in countries where there are the government suppression, you know, and they just feed it through radio and their TV stations.
Yes.
It's not hard to imagine you can have that control. And we all know it. We're aware of it. You know?
You mentioned TV. Do you recall getting your first TV in the home?
We were here, 56, and it was the classic thing, man. Like, it was another big thing, like fridges. Mum had to have a fridge, right?
Yes.
Because prior to that, it was the ice being box. Delivered with that's the horse right. and the cart. Right.
Do you remember as a kid that happening?
Absolutely. Yeah. In the sack.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, all that.
And if you're lucky, in the hot days, he'd chip off some ice for you.
All that.
Yeah.
Bloody, anyway, unbelievable. But... So the TV was this, site-driven kind of thing. And then whichever family was fortunate enough to have one, of course, the neighbourhood throng went around to check out Mickey Mouse Club, Robin Hood, you know, and whatever the major things were at the time.
Yes.
And it was great fun. Yeah, and we're all sitting there going, M-I-C-K-Y, you know, joining in the whole... They were great memories. And it was a sort of an innocent time. You were mentioning before about how a lot of the baby boomer stories are all very similar. And really, I think after the Second World War, like any war, and the armistice and the whole thing, there would have been euphoria there.
Hope.
And hope, the growth, the joy, and the moving on. And I think probably nowhere better in actual fact, because Australia was this... massive open opportunity. It was this world of stuff. And being a child was part of it. I can only remember those happy times. I can't remember any bad times.
Yes.
There was no bad times really for me in my entire upbringing, even as an only child.
Yes.
And I managed to make mates and stuff wherever I went. It didn't bother me. So, you know, as I said, when we went from Oamaru and then we went up to live in the Hawke's Bay, and then we went back to Wellington, out to the hut, you know, and I went to, the end of my intermediate school. They have intermediate over there, which is forms like 1 and 2. So it's a step up, gradual one, from your primary school through to high school.
Right.
So that's form 1 and 2, they call it intermediate.
Yes.
And you have a uniform and stuff.
Yes.
You get used to the whole drama. And then you go to high school, 3, 4, and 5, and 5 and 6 are university entrance, right, which is whatever that is here.
We'll finish up part one of Glenn's interview with the track I Ain't Got No Time For Nobody. The track was sung by Glenn in 1972 when he was part of Chain.
This program is a Handsome Dog production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.